KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. From the creation of Shakespeare in the Park to the birth of the public theater, perhaps no figure has created more of an amazing nonprofit theatrical enterprise than Joe Papp. In the new book, Free for All, written by Ken Turan, an oral history of Papp's world and those two entities, we get an astonishing look at this entire world. Kenny's also a film critic at the LA Times. Thanks for coming back. One thing that comes across in every chapter of the book is a love of language.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he had a restless intelligence and he loved language. He really loved Shakespeare. I mean, he was always thinking about it. He was always talking about it. He was always quoting it. You know, he liked to direct it. You know, I mean, he just, his whole life was wrapped up in that. I don't think it was an accident that, you know, he started with Shakespeare. I mean, some people say, well, he started with Shakespeare because it was free. But I think there was more to it than that.
One of the great things, too, that he says when he's fighting with Mayor Wagner's head of public resources is that, you know, the idea that Shakespeare should be free goes along with him for the idea of the public library being free.
Yeah, I mean, it saved him. You know, as a kid, he had a really, really, really poor childhood, the kind of childhood where his family would move in the middle of the night with all their belongings to avoid paying rent. You know, the kind of poverty that you don't really, that people don't usually rise that high out of. And it just, he believed, and, you know, he was a kind of a boy communist. He belonged to the Young Socialist League, you know, got into trouble later during McCarthy.
He was blacklisted. CBS, yeah. One of the few people who actually got his job back.
Yeah, he sued them. I mean, so, you know, he believed in this stuff. This wasn't like some kind of ploy to be powerful. He believed in this stuff for the people. It had saved him, and he felt it could save everybody. He was sincere. I mean, there's a lot of things people said about him, but I never heard anyone say that he was insincere, that it was all nonsense. He believed this stuff quite deeply.
It's funny because he almost struck me as being a Lenin-like figure, this guy who built these institutions and then turned on people in the same way that Lenin did.
Well, that's a good point. He was mercurial. I mean, I almost think they invented the word for him. As you know, as I say in the book, I mean, at some point he stopped this book. And I knew well before that happened that it was going to happen because Joe had a habit of at a certain point things would go south with people with him. And that was just the way it was. And, you know, I feared that it would happen with me and it did happen with me.
Because it happened with almost everyone. The only people it didn't happen with the people who he outlived.
But, you know, I mean, there's a wonderful line in the book. I talked to one of his playwrights, you know, who says, you know, they had some huge screaming fight the week before. And the playwright runs into him at an event. And Joe comes over and starts chatting with him like nothing had happened. And the playwright is flabbergasted. He said, Joe, we just had this enormous argument. And Joe just looks at him and says, if I didn't talk to the people I had arguments with, I'd have no one to talk to.
Part of what is clear to me in this book, more so than many oral histories I've read, is that the book is also about your own relationship to the material and what the passage of time did for you.
Yeah.
What do you think precipitated his turn on you? I mean, looking back on this now, I know you don't go into detail in the book, but what do you think it was?
It's really hard to know. I mean, you know, my personal feeling is that he read the book at a point. You know, the book was – I handed it – I mean, the book is long now. The original draft was much longer than this, and it probably needed some kinds of work, I mean, work that I ended up doing by myself.
Sure.
But, I mean, you know, in my mind what happened was almost at the same time as he got my first draft, Joe found out that he had the cancer that was going to kill him, and at the same time that his son Tony had the AIDS that was going to kill him. And I think it was just too much. You know, I think he just said, I just don't, you know, he was very famous for kind of just cutting and saying, okay, I'm not, you know, we're not doing this anymore. And I think he just said, I just don't need this. It's too much aggravation. I never found out specifically what troubled him about the book. I mean, he just said, I'm not happy.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Kenny Turan. We know him, of course, as a film critic for the LA Times. He's got a terrific new book, Free for All, a look at the inside of the creation of the public theater in Shakespeare in the Park with Joe Papp. It's a book, I have to say, I'm not particularly attracted to oral histories, oral biographies. And what's really interesting about this is that everybody has a very different take on him. I mean, it it really feels like Rashomon in a lot of ways.
It really does, and I ended up liking that. You know, initially when you talk to people, you want them all to be saying exactly the same thing so that it's tidy and neat. You know, it really was like Rashomon, or like I think of it kind of like a mosaic. You know, different people had different viewpoints and different pieces of the puzzle, and when you put them all together, you really get a sense of what he was like. Even though they don't agree on a lot of small things, if you take a step back, you can see how they're all really saying the same thing.
And you mentioned in the beginning of the book that about a quarter of the people had passed away because you stopped working on the book in the early 90s.
Yeah, well, earlier than that. I mean, I signed the contract in 86, and probably maybe 2 years later, 2-3 years later is when I stopped working on it. You know, I mean, I went through an interesting progression personally on this book. Initially, when Joel turned against it and said, well, this is not coming out, what I felt in a sense was personal aggrievement. I felt like I had been kind of messed over and that things had happened. You know, I had really been put upon and I was the injured party. And the longer this didn't happen, and especially when I started working on it again to cut it, I started to feel that what was important about this book was not what had happened to me, but that all these people had spoken and these people were dead and they were not going to tell their stories to anyone else. And I started to feel, rather than aggrieved for myself, I really started to feel a responsibility to these people. You know, we had talked about Roscoe Lee Brown, you know, all these people who had told me amazing stories, and they weren't going to tell them to anyone else anymore. And I just felt a real responsibility to get these stories out there, that these people had confided in me, they trusted in me, they told me stuff that was very important to them, and it just had to get out.
For example, I was shocked in the second chapter to find that he and Bob Fosse were in the Navy together, and he was Audie Murphy's theater teacher.
I know. It's just astonishing. When he told me the thing about Bob Fosse, I thought he was kidding me. We were on the same ship, you know. And then I called Bob Fawcett. He says, yeah, we were on the same ship. And I said, this is just insane, you know. He just connected and touched so many different people. And now that the book is out, I'm always running into people who are saying, you know, I started with Joe. I worked there for a summer. I was his assistant. You know, the number of people who he inspired, I think, was more than he even knew.
At some point, I guess the connective tissue is that there's a kind of a fight that almost everybody talks about. And I think about Martin Sheen's meeting with him where Sheen is doing Romeo and Juliet. And, of course, he says, well, it's the worst part in the world and it's really boring. Everybody knows your lines. I was born to do Mercutio. And Pap goes, yes, and that's why you're going to play Romeo.
He had a vision for what people ought to be doing. You know, he just was being a producer, I've talked to other theater people about this. Being a producer is a very kind of elusive quality. And it's easy for people to say, well, anyone could have that job. Anyone could produce. You know, the director, the playwright, the actors are important people. But it turns out in theater that the producer is a key person and that having that kind of vision is really important.
He really was maybe the last of the old school impresarios.
Yeah, yeah.
And I only read the legendary stories about getting hair on the stage and what that first production of that show was like.
Yeah.
When it was really what freeform sort of almost hippie theater was, and there's no better place for it than the public.
Yeah, and one of the things that's fascinating that, you know, friends of mine who are playwrights are very heartened by, every big success Joe had, nobody wanted, you know. Everyone said hair. People thought he was out of his mind. You know, a tribal love rock musical. I mean, they really thought that, you know, he ought to lie down and take a sedative. You know, no one wanted a chorus line. Nobody wanted a normal heart. You know, all these things that became huge things. Only Joe really saw them as potentially successful. This was a gift he had. He just had a gift.
It's the truth. I'm talking to Ken Duran. He's, of course, film critic for the LA Times. His terrific book on the public and Joe Papp is Free for All. That title, it was perfect.
I'm very happy with the title, you know, because it's got those two meanings. You know, free Shakespeare, affordable stuff was the key to his belief. But it was a free for all. He kind of butted heads with almost anyone he came into contact with.
Yep. There are these stories of astonishing generosity. I just think about him finding Sheila Vaughan, who was basically his partner, his assistant. And in the 50s, he started to tell her, you should direct at the time when people weren't telling women to direct.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's a great story about him, you know, running into Wallace Shawn on the street. And Wallace Shawn at that point was like working in the garment district, you know, kind of pushing carts. And he says, what are they paying you? And he says, you know, X dollar a week. And Joe said, I'll pay you that much to write plays. And there was no, you know, really way to know that he would turn into a hugely successful playwright. But Joe believed in him, and Joe put his money where his belief was. He didn't just say, you know, someday you won't have to do this. He said, I'm going to give you the money right now so you can stop pushing carts.
It's also that great thing, too. You've got the story where you've got a few soliloquies And you give people a chance to basically do a monologue.
Yeah, exactly.
In the piece. And one of the great ones comes from Charles Durning, who tells this story about, apropos what you're saying about Wally Shawn, where he just, he was broke, he had two kids, another child on the way, and Pap says, well, how much do you need to live? And he said, well, I could use $700. He said, no, how much do you need?
Yeah.
And he said, $1,400. And he gave it to him.
Yeah.
And he'd never done it with any actor before or since.
No. He was, and again, you know, he understood poverty because of the way he grew up. It was not a theory to him. So if people said, you know, he could tell when people really needed something. There's so many actors that he picked out, not only Durning, Martin Sheen, Christopher Walken, you know, Raul Julia. I mean, they called Joe up and he said, okay, you know, I'm going to use you. You're good. You know, and he, you know, he. No one else was saying that to these people. No one else was doing this. Yeah. You know?
Or even George C. Scott, who at one point probably said he looked like a Marine on stage, which he was.
Yeah. You know, that was one of George C. Scott's really great roles, first role, Richard III, you know, even before they were in the park uptown in, you know, a theater, the Heckscher Theater. And, you know, he just saw something in him. He tells a funny story. He said he wasn't sure. There was another actor, he says, that, you know, we haven't heard from since. It was this guy or George C. Scott. And he says, you know, and he laughed and he said, well, you don't have to be right all the time. You just need a percentage. And Joe definitely had a percentage.
And in all these stories, even when there's generosity, there's still friction in the heart of all these things.
Yeah, well, Joe was a stern taskmaster. You know, he believed in stuff. And he believed in his view of the theater. He believed in how plays should go. He had specific ideas about specific plays. His life experiences, what he'd gone through, who he was, really helped him in terms of dealing with people. Even though he could be abrasive, he really cared about people, understood people, was really kind of, someone describes him as kind of Harry in the Night, you know, from the Henry plays, you know, walking among the troops, you know, before Agincourt. And I think there is an element to that about him.
We say you're talking about the show, that championship season by Jason Miller. And there's also a contentious relationship between Miller and Papp as well.
You know, Jason Miller, you know, wanted to be in The Exorcist. And it wasn't clear that everyone thought this was a good idea. You know, a lot of people kind of had conflicts with Joe when they wanted to take a little time off from the theater to go to Hollywood and make money. And Joe just thought they really shouldn't be doing that.
I mean, there's a great story we were just talking about before we got started that his first wife tells about how they had married and they were wandering the streets. They needed two rings for the ceremony. Only had one, and they just saw one in the gutter.
I mean, I don't know. What can you say? You know, at key moments in his career, you know, we found that first church just walking around, Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. I mean, that's where everything started. And he just was wandering around the city. He sees this church. He goes in. He talks to the kindly old padre. And the guy says, sure, you could put on theater here. You know, I mean, and it was unheated. It was the middle of winter. It wasn't like an ideal place, but it was a place. He found theater seats somewhere up in the Bronx that they schlepped down to the church, you know. It wasn't easy things that happened, but opportunities would present themselves and Joe would seize them.
I just can't help but think that part of what you loved about doing this story so much was that it was probably the last creation of a public institution that still had like this life, because you were there with the guy who built it literally from the floor up in both circumstances.
Yeah. No, it was amazing to see what he had done, you know, what he had created. I mean, he was the unlikeliest. And, you know, we've been saying he's a poor guy. He's a guy who did not go to college, you know, was in the service. And he was not the guy who you think is going to start this kind of theater. You know, but he ended up doing it and he made it a success. You know, just his gifts, his personality, his will, his determination. He created, you know, what is now one of the great New York institutions.
We'll take a break. My guest is Kenneth Turan. Of course, he's a film critic at the LA Times. But his terrific new book is An Oral History of the Public and Shakespeare in the Park. It's free for all. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Sitting across from me with his terrific new book, Free for All, A History of Joe Papp in the Public, is Kenny Turan, film critic of the LA Times. Ken, there's a paragraph in the introduction that you write that I think summarizes both the book and your attachment to the material. Could you read it for us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. With the difference in perspective that the passage of time and perhaps even an increased maturity provided, I felt more strongly what should have been obvious from the start. The most dramatic aspect of Joe's story is not whom he locked horns with, but what he accomplished. All of his battles, all the clashes of will and temperament are here in their full glory. How could they not be, given his life? But what he achieved against truly impossible odds dwarfs everything else. While Joe was alive, there was a sense from the doubters that if he hadn't done what he did, someone else likely would have. Today, with no one since his death having come anywhere near his level of accomplishment, it's clearer than ever how singular his life's work has been. When I started to work on the book again, it was really 20 years after I'd done the first work, and I had a change in perspective. I started to feel, as I said, that, you know, I owed it to these people that this was history, that I had to get out there. You know, I had so many people took so much time. I mean, David Brabe talked to me for hours. You know, he had the most complicated
that relationship. That was the most heartbreaking thing. I mean, that could be a book in itself, relationship with the playwright David Rabe, of course. But, I mean, and Rabe's own kind of maturation, then that horrible split that they had.
Yeah, it was really like, it was a real father. It was a, you know, they were not father and son, but there were so many elements of a father-son relationship, which they both recognized. You know, it just kind of wrenched both of them. You could write a play about their relationship.
It was really a David Rabe play.
Yeah, it was.
Finally, bitterness and anger are at the heart of every familial relationship.
I know. But they were, you know, there were so many people that Joe had those kind of relationships with.
Well, one of the things that I found so fascinating about the book, and I wonder if you saw this, is that in so many ways it reminds me of what the beginnings of what we think of now the independent film movement got started. That same kind of headlong passion. You could look at any number of the big films in the late 80s and early 90s, and they were all films that people were told not to bet against. Not to bet for, rather.
Yeah.
Everybody was betting against them, that none of them would happen. And it was the same kind of thing. And it seems to be kind of a point of attraction for you.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, I like those kind of stories. Well, they're very dramatic stories, you know. I mean, the stories are fighting against the odds, you know. Will the serum get through to Nome, you know? Those kinds of stories are great stories, you know. So, you know, I mean, Joe, I mean, the odds were phenomenal against Joe, you know. I mean, the whole thing, just like you would have said, never, ever, ever. I mean, just forget about it. It wouldn't even, like, the odds were long. You would say, you know, you can't even make this bet.
At a certain point, it's just that he almost treated things like they were a show, like it was a play. At a certain point, it's just, well, you know, this is done.
Yeah.
Oh, I can see the end coming. Let's walk away from this. And one of the most crucial pieces in this entire story is the big anniversary party that was thrown for him.
Yeah.
And tell that story, if you will.
Well, that's kind of, to me, that's kind of the emotional linchpin of the thing. You know, Bernie Gersten was his right-hand person. They met right after the Army. They had been friends for decades. He was the number two at the Public Theater, and really they were a fabulous team. And Bernie decided, it's an odd birthday, but it was Joe's 57th birthday. He kind of thought of like Heinz 57 varieties. And he put together this enormous, very elaborate surprise birthday party for Joe at the Public, where all like four former mayors of New York City were there. This was at the Delacorte Theater in the Park. And all kinds of celebrities and actors were there. It was like one of the parties of the century. Joe enjoyed it while it was happening, and afterwards, he kind of had second thoughts about it. He was kind of unnerved by it. And it led ultimately to a split with him between him and Bernie. And Bernie had to leave the Public. You know, he fired Bernie, who was his like alter ego, the closest person to him professionally.
And I have to say, too, in reading the book, you develop a relationship with Bernie because Bernie is in 2/3 of the book.
Yeah. Well, Bernie was there for everything. I mean, Bernie was like really the kind of number two person that everyone dreams about. You know, he was smart. He was capable. He knew what he was doing. He's now at the Lincoln Center doing terrific work there. It was inconceivable to people that they would split up, and they did.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Ken Turan, of course, film critic of the LA Times. His terrific book, The Oral History of the Public and Joe Papp's Own Life and that creation of that entity, is the book Free for All. And the interesting thing, too, is that he basically, that person he became after he had left the network where he was a floor manager was the person he was for most of his career.
Yeah.
It's just that most people didn't have that long a period with him.
Yeah,
so that,
yeah.
that window of time that they had, they could only offer the reflections on the time they spent with him.
Yeah, and Bernie had all this time with him, you know, and Bernie really had seen, you know, what he was like. And, you know, I mean, Bernie more than anyone else knew what a remarkable person Joe was. You know, I mean, it was so sad that the split up was so sad. You know, and no one, I mean, Jerry, you know, there's a wonderful story about Jerry Schoenfeld, who was like the most powerful, you know, head of the Schubert Organization, the most powerful man in New York theater, maybe in theater nationwide. And he wants to talk to Joe about the split up. And Joe makes him sit outside in his office for like an hour. You know, Jerry Schoenfeld doesn't sit outside people's offices for an hour. It probably hadn't happened to him in 50 years. You know, there's a theater named after him now in New York, you know. But Joe was just, that's, you know, he was a law unto himself.
And always was.
Yeah,
I mean,
always was.
It wasn't like he grew into this impresario. There was always this enormous force of will that you talk about
existed there. Yeah, he was. He got by surviving his childhood. You know, this horrific childhood, and you know, just when you added in the kind of notion of kind of the public good that he got from his youthful political radicalism, this turned it into really a formidable force for good. Really, finally, a formidable force for art, for great theater. I mean, he wasn't like P.T. Barnum. You know, all his gifts was towards really doing the best possible theater for the most people. And that's a hard thing to argue against.
I guess I just found myself thinking, though, one of the things that I love so much about the book, and it's something that's lost on people if you've never been to a show, is Shakespeare in the Park, is how it is almost like being a part of Twelfth Night itself.
Yeah.
That weird sense of humidity and dizziness and unpredictability of the weather, planes going overhead, sirens going around, fireflies. I mean, half the shows you see the public at the Shakespeare in the Park are kind of terrible, but the atmosphere is so wonderful.
It's a very heady atmosphere, and you know, everyone, you know, every actor who's been there has their own stories to tell. I mean, actors think it's just like one of the most amazing things they've ever done because of all the things you mentioned. I mean, it is far from a hermetic experience. You know, the whole world is in there with you. You know, but the audiences love it. I mean, from the beginning that Joe took the theater around the boroughs, I mean, they're wonderful photographs. Some of them are in the book of people just loving these plays. You know, Joe really correctly understood that Shakespeare could be a mass taste, you know. And this is something that even sounds weird to say today, but Joe understood it and he made that happen. People came out in neighborhoods, in poor neighborhoods. They came, you know, Joe would truck this portable stage, you know, before he was in the park, he took this portable stage all through the five boroughs, you know, and people would come out and they'd enjoy. You see it in the pictures. They're liking the plays. You know, even though it sounds crazy, you have evidence.
No, it's funny because I just, in my documentary Blacklist, we have Whoopi Goldberg in the last segment, the last edition, and she talks about seeing those shows to the public.
Oh, really?
And how that made her want to go back when these things came to her neighborhood.
Wow.
And what's now Chelsea, she just fell in love with and said, I want to be on stage with those people and do that thing.
That's amazing. No, Joe inspired so many people. I mean, he understood that theater was powerful, not just for an elite, but for everyone. And that may not sound like a revolutionary notion, but in its day, it was a revolutionary notion. And it really turned out to be true.
And bringing all those playwrights who, again, were battlers as much as he. I mean, we talk about Whoopi Goldberg, but Ntozake Shange's for Color Girls Who Considered Suicide. I mean, each one of these plays, and the point is made by the participants, was so precedent-shattering that there was no place for it. And like you were saying, everybody said no beforehand.
Yeah, and even Ntozake Shange said, you know, he said, I'm bringing this to Broadway. And she said no. And then she said, who's going to be in it? And he said, you're going to be in it. She said, you know, nothing in her, everything in her life was pointing in the other way. She was not pointing towards being on Broadway. But Joe said, you have to do it. And she did it. And it was a great thing.
I just wonder one of the things, because as a film critic, one of the things that we don't get to see as often as we'd like is acting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
yeah.
controlled by the cuts, by the music, by everything else.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if this changed the way you thought about actors having spent this much time as people who pour their very beings into
it.
Yeah,
it gives you enormous respect for actors, for what they go through and how hard it is and how much they really put themselves on the line. You feel it much more strongly in theater, I think, because there is nothing else to mitigate it. They can't be saved by editing or retakes or anything else. They have to do it right there. And their willingness to sacrifice and to do it and to put themselves out there. I think you're right. It really made a big impact on me talking to so many of them about what they'd been through.
Were you a big theater goer as a kid?
Not that much. But, you know, my sister took me to Shakespeare in the Park when I was in high school.
What did you see? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but I remember really liking it. You know, I had a classic Joe audience experience. I said, well, you know, this stuff is fun.
I mean, because your interests are so varied. I mean, there's pulp, there's sports, there's film. And all these things that you're interested in, but the combative aspect of so many of these elements come to play in this material, don't they?
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. I think maybe that's why I understood, you know, even though I could never, you know, I understood why Joe did what he did. I mean, it didn't seem like he seemed very understandable to me. I was able to talk to Joe and I just connect with him on those levels. I mean, also, you know, Yiddish-speaking immigrant parents, you know, I mean, I'm really in some ways the youngest person with that background. You know, Joe was like 20 years older than me, but our, you know, growing up years were remarkably similar. You know, even though I could not have done what he did in a million lifetimes. But, I mean, his way of being, his background, I got it.
It's a treatment. My guest is Ken Duran. Of course, again, his book is Free for All, the story of Joe Papp in the public. But if there's an analog for me, and this must have occurred to you, it's the Yankees of the mid-70s as skippered by Billy Martin.
Yeah.
That impossible group of egos and talents and people who are helping as well as people who are hurting the team. Yeah. But you took one person who knew exactly what he wanted, who half the people couldn't stand, and went to work with him anyway. This really felt to me like that story of the Yankees of that era.
You know, the one I think of, the one play that really is that way is, you know, is championship season.
Oh, my God. Talk a little bit about
that.
Well,
these guys, you know, there were five actors and, they were just fractious. I mean, the word, it was almost invented for that. They really, during the entire rehearsal period, you know, they needled each other. They teased each other. One guy used to put change on the floor of the stage, like dimes and nickels and quarters, to throw the other actors off their lines, you know, make them go up on their lines.
Paul Sorvino, who was like – who was of this group of really combative, selfish actors, was the most selfish
I mean, they made each other crazy. People were like scared to even be in rehearsal because they were just like tearing each other apart. But Joe somehow kept the ship afloat. You know, he just said, it's going to be okay. And it was – it won the Pulitzer Prize. It was more than okay, you know.
But you must feel now, because you had to talk to his widow about this. And what was that first conversation? The very first time you made touch, what was that like? Were you nervous about that?
I was a little nervous, but I mean, I wrote her a letter. It was the first contact I had with her before. You know, I hadn't seen her in a number of years.
How much time had passed between?
Oh, God, 10, 12 years.
Okay.
And I wrote her a letter, and I basically said, you know, and this was, you know, just very sincere on my part. I mean, I said, this is too important a story not to be told in this way. This has to come out. And, you know, she wrote me back and she said, you know, this is worth talking about.
I guess I find myself wondering about this. And you even mentioned that in the foreword, he tells, if they're telling you the story about his almost unendurable poverty, and he just says, that's it, I'm never telling that story again.
Yeah.
I wonder if part of him felt like he couldn't live through this anymore, and that's why he didn't want to see it in print.
That could be. I think he, you know, maybe he had liked the notion of an oral history, of a history of what he'd been through, and then when he actually was confronted with it, something about it didn't work for him. Like I say, he just said no, and it just was such a shock that I never pursued it. I never said, I want to hear why.
I'm glad you came by to have a conversation to hear about it. Thanks so much, Kenny.
Well, thank you, Elvis. This has been great.
My guest is Kenny Turan. Kenneth Turan, forgive me the imprecision here. His book on Joe Papp and the public is Free for All. Our recording engineer at KCRW is Mario Diaz. The editor is Bob Carlson. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.